Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. We're back, and we're glad to be back. After 2 years of eager anticipation, we're here to discuss season two of The Witcher, which is now available for streaming on Netflix. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and for those who are joining us for the first time, we're cousins who love to explore the worlds of fantasy and sci-fi shows. In the past, we've discovered the multiverse of His Dark Materials, examined the bending of Avatar, The Last Airbender, and The Legend of Korra, and uncovered the secrets of Lovecraft Country. You can find our coverage of season one of The Witcher in your podcast feeds. If you want to go back and listen, we'd love it.
This week, we'll discuss several reunions. Yen makes it back to Aretuza to find a, less than welcoming circumstance. Hmm. Triss Marigold makes a play for the White Wolf in episodes 3 and 4 of season 2.
And ladies and gentlemen, you've been a beautiful audience. Remember to toss a coin if you can. We'll be over at the bar serving up some adult content with your boy Yaskier's new single On Blast. Burn, butcher, burn! Oh, man. What a follow-up. Here we go.
It just doesn't do it for me. I'm sorry.
No, I mean,
it's not toss a coin. Toss a coin was stuck in my head for like a year.
Yes, I mean, it does not have the same kind of earworm quality as we'll discuss. But it's a decent follow-up, maybe a little bit of a sophomore slump.
Yeah. It's not my favorite.
I mean, we'll get there, but let's talk about Kaer Morhen and what's happening there when we start off episode 3. Ciri is taking her training a bit too seriously, and Geralt is feeling extremely guilty about the fact that he had to kill his friend Eskel. Ciri's determination helps her to get nearly to the end of most of the difficult course in the training yard, but it's not enough, and it's sometimes too much all at the same time.
Can we just talk about how she was really looking for some sympathy when she almost made it to the end and then she flamed out and Geralt was like, so close.
He was tight though, because he's like, yo, what are you doing out here trying to like accelerate the process? Like, and you know, he reminds her too, right? That she hasn't undergone the mutations that allow witches to survive such trials. So, like, she could kill herself. Like, literally, she could fall off and break her neck.
Yeah, I mean, he's salty because he told her to sit down and chill out, and she's over here doing the absolute most. I mean, I have to say I was impressed, but
yeah,
she's doing the absolute most. Ciri, take a seat.
And Lambert is egging her on, like, just being a jerk. Like, he's just like, go, go, go. You know what I mean? Like, she obviously did not hear the, when I say run, run. she was off that. So Geralt also soon realizes that Ciri is the one who is attracting the monsters. She tells him her visions would lead her to the forest when they first got to Kaer Morhen. And they see the Leshy that infected Eskel when they go back out to the forest, but that monster is quickly eaten by a larger, faster, and remarkably more terrifying freaking monster.
I mean, I legit was like, what the hell is this? Like, when I saw it, I was like, this thing is a thing of stuff of nightmares. Like, what is it? It's like some kind of centipede. It's disgusting.
That monster was like Cat Williams when he was like, a Chrysler 300 looks like a Bentley until a Bentley pull up. You know what I mean? Like, that monster was like a monster until a real monster came. That shit was wild. So Geralt gets the monster to, you know, basically the monster starts chasing Ciri, and Geralt finally, eventually kills the monster in remarkable fashion. I thought it was, you know, he's really good at, he's just good, man. He's just like, obviously the best out there. And then we cut to Yen coming back, showing up to Aretuza, where, you know, they're counting all the people that are dead, and she's kind of comes in and flexes and says, nah, I'm not dead. I'm not dead. I'm here. And she reunites with Taseya and finds the Brotherhood in a power struggle. Very quickly, Yen learns that she will not be held up as a champion. that instead they want her to lay low. Believing her to be a spy, Stregobor also tries to torture Yen, but is stopped by Taseya. And what a fucking dirtbag. Like he literally, I just don't love what, I mean, obviously Taseya did that, the same thing to Kahir episode, and we kind of were.
Okay. Yes, it was wrong. But like, Kahir is the enemy. Yen is one of your own.
But Stregobor is always dislike Yen because of what he thinks she is, right? He knows that she has elven blood. He knows that she, you know, is to say his favorite. He has a lot of, he's, you know, look at all the conniving he did with Istrid first season. You know what I mean? Like, so I get.
Right. But all right, I just need to have this moment. I hate Stregobor so much. I've been out on Stregobor since episode one. I remember being like, this wizard is garbage.
Super garbage.
I hate him so much. When Yen is like, I always figured you were, what you call him, a pervert. I was like, yes, that's the vibe he gives. He's terrible. You know, justice for Renfri,
yeah,
because she didn't have to die. It was off of some BS, a misunderstanding. Word. And Stregobor is trash.
And she's not all wrong, right? Either, right? The very first time we see Stregobor, he's got all these naked women hanging out, like, as like part of his, like, his freaking spell. It's like, what the? He's a little bit pervy, for sure. 100%. Like, yes, we're not fans. We're not fans at all. We're out on him. I'm with you. I feel
like about Stregobor the way you felt about Azrael in the first season.
Oh, that's saying a lot. I think I'm more out on Stregobor than Azrael. So that tells you something right there.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That tells you something right there.
That's deep. Because I don't even think Mrs. Coulter dislikes Azrael as much as you
listen,
do.
Listen, like, Stregobor is a failure as a man. And he also should never, ever be a fucking father. He doesn't even get to a failure as a father. He's a failure as a man. He should never be. You know what I mean? What, at all. Oh, man. So, you know, Taseya basically shuts down all of what Stregobor is trying to do to Yen. But she also thinks that to prove that she's not a spy, Taseya basically suggests that Yen execute Kahir. At the dedication of the memorial to the 13 mages who died at Sodden Hill. Instead, after she hears a voice of the witch from the doorless hut, Yen frees Kahir and the two of them escape on horseback. Man. Yeah.
Yeah, that was... Can I just say that the scene where they're escaping on horseback, what beautiful... Like, that was gorgeous.
It was beautiful. I mean, this whole scene.
It was incredibly beautiful. I think that scene was in the trailer, but we couldn't tell who it was.
Yeah.
It is stunningly beautiful. I mean, this show is just... The production value has just been incredible this whole season.
Yeah, it's
just beautiful.
On another level. Like, I'm honestly really impressed with what they've done. You can see why they were in there, like, to go a little meta for a second, while they were in there color correcting the way that they were, as long as they were in post, like when we would see like the updates, because they just nailed it. The way this thing looks is amazing. So
yeah, every single scene just looks really beautiful, and some of the locations just look really authentic to what people, like those who've read the books, and definitely people who have played the games, like Kaer Morhen looks perfect.
Oh, it looks great. It's so
good. And we're going to go to Oxenfurt in this next episode, and it also looks incredible. I mean, it's beautiful. So, anyway.
So, in Sintra, Frangilla and Francesca, to close this out in this episode, seal their alliance. And Francesca tells Frangilla that she's expecting a child and wants to secure the future of her people. Both come clean, right? They both say, you know what? What they saw in their visions, they're pretty clear that it was not prophetic, which is remarkable, right? Because they're like, yeah, this is not actually going to happen. But it helped them arrive at a conclusion, which is a strong one, that they could be useful to each other moving forward.
So I like this part because I had actually thought that Frangilla and Francesca were like a little bit naive.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. At the end of, I guess that was episode two, when it's clear that Yen isn't buying whatever this woman in the hut is selling. But mm-hmm. they did. I was like, oh, these dummies.
Yeah. But Franny, what are you doing?
But clearly they understood that, you know, basically this woman in the hut just gave them a good idea, which makes sense. Like, it does make sense for Nilfgaard and the elves to form an alliance because the northern kingdoms are so trash.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it would be... I thought it was a move by Frangilla. And I think... I mean, I feel like because we have Frangilla and we have Francesca, we need to come up with a new nickname for Frangilla.
Yeah, Franny doesn't really work anymore, does it?
No, because Francesca is actually like Franny. She could be Franny. She mm-hmm. could be, but it would get confusing. So... more on that. I mean, like the law firm of Fran and Fran. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. We're working on it. It's a work in progress.
So in episode 4, which is called Redanian Intelligence, we're back at Kaer Morhen and an unexpected guest arrives. It's Triss Marigold. She got called away from Aretusa.
Did she get called away or did she boat trying to quench that thirst?
So she's come to care for Cirilla. When Geralt fills Triss in, she decides to perform an experiment on the monster that he killed in the previous episode. Afterward, Triss tries to make a move on Geralt, but, you know, it is declined.
This is the most, like, she's basically like, come to my bed. It's like the most non-subtle, you can smash, bro. Like, come, let's go. Like, this is gonna happen. Like, go. And Geralt is doing Geralt shit. Like, he's just like, nah, I'm out on that. You don't have a unicorn. Sorry.
Wow. He doesn't even enjoy the unicorn. Wow, the unicorn had to come up. You just
he doesn't even enjoy the unicorn. This is where he's flawed. How do you not enjoy the unicorn situation? Anyway, the point is that he is shutting Triss down. I don't get it, because I guess the wish is there. I mean, I know and she's about to spill the beans when he cuts her off about Yen still being alive. And then he like cuts her off.
Yeah, because she's listing the names of all of the people who died. Obviously, if he just let her finish, Yen's name would not have been there.
Yeah, exactly. But he's like assuming, oh, she's gone. So let me just cut you off.
Let's take a beat here. I don't remember exactly what their conversation was, even though I've seen this episode a million times. But when Triss and Yen discuss Geralt, it's clear, right, that Yen and him have a thing, right?
Yeah, 110%. Actually, Triss goes into talking about him while they're walking towards the battle at Sodden Hill. And then they start mm-hmm. going back and forth about it and having that whole conversation. But I just think, I mean, Triss is like, listen, whatever's going on with you guys is going on with you guys. Geralt's just way too fucking serious. She's not even like, yo, I want to marry you, Geralt. I want to be with you forever. Even though book readers will know that there's more context to this, that she wants a little bit more than what he's able to give. But that seems like the story of fucking Geralt. Like, this was just going to be a one-nighter. Who's saying that she? I don't understand.
Okay, hold up a second, though. Geralt is a father.
This is true.
Cirilla's looking at her like, who the hell is this? You've been saying Yen's name in your damn sleep. Like, who is this person? And he's focused on other things. Like, he's not interested in this right now.
I get it. And Triss, you know, God, it's so hard because I try not to conflate show and stuff we've read and things that we know about gameplay and all that. But I will say Triss has some real flagrantly whack behavior that she has enacted towards Geralt outside of the show. So maybe they're trying to play into that, like that he's just like turned off, whatever. But whatever it is, he's like, nah, I'm out on this. I'm out on Triss Marigold. Sorry, Marigold.
Yeah, he's heartbroken. I hear you, but it's just.
I just feel like Triss gets the raw end of the stick. It's sad. I feel bad for Triss. I do, exactly. But she gets back at all of them later on, as we can see.
Yeah, it's sad, but anyway. So on to more important mages. Near Oxenfort.
What a tough look.
Yennefer and Kahir are trying to sort of contemplate their next move. And we get a glimpse of how awful the elves are treated in the Northern Kingdom. Kahir is desperate to get back to Sintra because that's where the Nilfgaardian army or whatever's left of it is held up. Yen is pretty much just concerned about survival because that's our girl. That's how she always is. She's just trying to get, you know, prevent being arrested. They end up in the sewers with two elves hiding from soldiers, including one who is Mr. Mosley from Downton Abbey.
Good catch. I noticed that as well. I was like, whoa.
I only noted it because I looked down from the screen and I heard his voice and I was like, Mr. Mosley? And here they learn about the Sandpiper, an ally of the elves that helps them escape to Zintria or Sintra.
We need better branding. The Sandpiper is just not a good branding. So
a monster attacks them in the sewers, and they eventually try to get back to the Sandpiper, and it turns out that the Sandpiper is our very own Yaskier doing his very best Taylor Swift impression with a new breakup song about his friend.
One fire. Gerald, why'd you break up with me? Didn't we have it all? Mister, you care only about yourself. Burn, but you burn. He's so sad. Why is he so salty?
It's, well, listen, that episode of season one, where I call it the breakup episode, everybody broke up.
Yeah.
The last time I watched it, I was very upset with Geralt. I mean, I've always been upset with Geralt about it, but it's like, he's so mean to him.
For no reason. And all he did was improve your brand. Like, I mean, the brand is strong because of Yaskier. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
It's so bad. So
Yen and Yaskier reunite. You know, they have a few dunks on Geralt. And she asked for his help to get to Sintra. That evening, after creating a distraction, which we will talk about later because it is absolutely hilarious, Yaskier helps Yen, Kahir, and the other elves board a ship to Sintra. But then something happens to him once they're boarded, and Yen has to leave the ship to find out what happened. Meanwhile, King Vizmir of Redania survives an assassination attempt with the help of his head spy, my favorite person, Dijkstra. I love Dijkstra. I am a Dijkstra stan.
Are you really?
Yes. Yes, Dijkstra does some terrible things in the, you know, world, books, show, game.
Yes.
But I still like
this
him.
This is your freaking evil adjacent coming back out. Like, right there. This is it. I don't understand. What do you mean?
He's great. He's great. You will say nothing bad about Dijkstra.
You know who I will say something bad about, though? Fucking Mr. Mosley, the elf that we found down in the sewer. This guy boated on the poor kid he got ate, just like his character in Downton. I was like, dude, why are you boating? You're switching sides again? Like, you're wild. Like, you're kind of a turncoat.
Wow. I can't believe you came for Mr. Mosley.
I'm just
like
saying.
That.
I'm just saying, he left that poor dude. That dude got eaten alive. He was out. Yen even calls him on it. It was fucking terrible. Anyway.
Yeah, but then he sacrifices himself.
Yeah, I know. But only because he got. You think he would have done that had he not got guilted?
No. Yeah,
exactly.
Just like Mr. Mosley wouldn't have helped, you know, run a soup kitchen for veterans if he hadn't been a draft dodger.
Exactly. This is what I'm saying. This guy has been typecast. I don't know what's going on.
So Dijkstra and King Vizmir discuss the options before them, and it seems that it might be the time to strike at Nilfgaard and take Sintra from them. Back at Kaer Morhen, Triss reads the Witcher's four filth for their treatment of Ciri, who just wants to be one of them. I mean, she's basically like, you treat her terrible, you don't let her bathe, you laugh at her, you make jokes at her expense, you don't feed her properly. I mean, she just,
yeah, I mean, like,
she destroys
them. It's like one of those, it's like one of those things where I just didn't, all right, I didn't get the Excel, like reading the book, I understand like there's a lot more context to this as to why she reads them like this, because there's also like the whole part about like them giving her like herbs and her having her cycle and like her developing as a young woman and them being dumb. I felt like this was a little bit elevated based on like what was happening, but I did think she was right to read them because of how they laughed at her when she was like trying to look nice and dress like nicely. And, you know, she felt like she wanted to impress not only them, but also Triss, because Triss was new there, and just how they went about it was shitty. So like, I love what Triss does here. Like, I really do. Like, I really love how she stands up for her. And I wish they would have added more of the other reasons as to why she reads them in the books. I think that would have been really interesting in this scene, you know?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I did watch this scene before I actually read that passage in the book. So I hear what you're saying. I agree that in the book, there's a lot more evidence for them mistreating Cirilla. But I also just think that Lambert and Cohen are so like brutish to Cirilla, and also are making, like, Lambert's making all these digs at Geralt over Eskel, which is also pointed at Cirilla. And so I think it was nice for another woman to stand up for her, because she's a teenage girl. She admires them. So the fact that they had to make her feel bad about it when all these dudes spent most of their teenage years trying to be like Vesemir is, you know, they deserved it.
Yeah, but I guess where I'm going at. Okay, so like, I won't go too deep. I don't want to take us too far away from the summary, but I guess where I'm going at is like, the creator, she kind of talks a lot about that, you know, there's going to be some things around gender and about, you know, just gender roles, gender dynamics, also just gender as a whole. And I just found it interesting that she didn't lean into the part where Ciri's really like, hey, you know, when she's meeting Triss, she's like, hey, can you make me a boy? Like, I thought that would have been like, because that really triggers Triss, because Triss kind of feels like, in the book anyway, she kind of feels like, wait, like, why do you want, and then seeing like the state of how she's dressed and how she looks and what's going on makes her see that, like, hey, they haven't really been treating her well. And that leads her to like be like, what the fuck is wrong with you guys? Which kind of, I guess maybe they wanted to let them off the hook a little bit. They wanted to seem abusive, like, or any sort of like neglect. But I also feel like that really triggers Triss to why she makes them make some of the changes to how they deal with Ciri, which ultimately forms who Ciri is how she's being raised. You know what I mean? In some ways, you know what I mean? Early anyway.
Well, I agree with you on this. The writers definitely made the Witchers less, like, they made Kaer Morhen seem like a better place for Ciri than it is in the book. And Geralt is a better father. Then he clearly read some parenting books before he went and picked up his child of surprise, because he's not a very effective parent before Triss comes into the story. Lambert is actually, in my opinion, meaner in the show than he is in the book. So, and so is Cohen. I mean, I guess Cohen is not really mean to her, but
he's strict.
He's very strict. He doesn't really silence. Sorry?
I said he's very strict. He's more strict in the training, and he's just very consistent.
He's also aged up. Mm-hmm. Like, in the book, he's a little older than Ciri. He's not, like, you know, a grown man. But anyway, I hear you. There's a, you know, we should reserve.
Yeah.
In our final episode, just to talk about some of these differences and why they're somewhat annoying. To people who love the books, because there are some character things that were choices that were made that are a little bit frustrating. And I hear you that this is one of them. Like, the evidence for Triss yelling at them isn't as strong here as it would be if they had stuck to what was in the books.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody slipped.
I still thoroughly enjoyed it, but
me too. I loved it too because they get, what is it? They get to the notes that you want to see happen without all, but it, you know, they're just, I just felt like, it was like a quick jump, and it was like, if you didn't know some of those other things, because I actually saw this after I read this passage, so I'd had the opposite effect where I was like, oh, this is where she's gonna like get on them. And then I watched this and I was like, oh yeah, that's a big jump from like what was going on. But I hear you. No, I do feel what you're saying. And I also feel you that Geralt got, you know, chicken soup for the child surprise.
Oh man, I used to love those chicken soup
books. Were good.
We're dating ourselves. So Triss goes back to her experiment and it reveals that there is stellacite, which is the material that monoliths are made of. Ciri confesses that when she screamed outside of Syntra, when Kahir was in pursuit of her, she shattered a monolith, which
wow
is insane.
Yeah.
And also, I actually went back to that scene in the first episode. She definitely does shatter a monolith. We just didn't know what it was. So to find out more, Triss decides to portal Geralt to Syntra so that he can learn more from her very good friend, Isred.
Awkward.
Ooh, this is awkward.
Oh, man.
While Geralt is away, Vesemir notes that wherever Ciri has bled... Okay, this flower has a wildest spelling. Y'all can just look it up, but it's pronounced Fenwood. Grows... It's a blue flower that only grows where elder blood has been shed, and it means that Ciri might carry the very blood that is the ingredient to the mutagen that creates witchers.
Wow.
Which is a huge twist. It is a huge twist. A twist that I love.
I love this twist.
I don't believe that's true in the books. I obviously have not finished the books, but I think this is an entirely made up thing for the show, and I kind of... Like, I know it messes with some of the magic. I hear that. But I was, like, shocked by this.
Yeah.
I thought this was a nice shocker.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It was yeah, for sure. I thought it was pretty shocking. I haven't gone that far either to know whether this is in the books at all. Or if it's just, you know, maybe it's... You're a game player. It's not in the games either, I'm assuming, from the quest that you've taken.
No, I mean, if it's in the games, it's a detail that's not prominent, because I felt like this was shocking.
Yeah.
Like, when this was revealed, my mouth was hanging open. Like, wait, what? Because my understanding of the Witcher mutation in the lore is that it's, like, a number of things, but you need a mage to help create, you know, the mutagen. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I thought this was genuinely... I was shook. I was like, wait, what?
That's wild. I feel like, can we just say Triss is low key hating though? Like, she gonna go ahead and just like, she got no other really good friends she could have paired Geralt up with. Like, she's like, yo, let me I'm gonna get you in touch with somebody. You should meet Isred.
In fairness, I don't think anyone... Isred is a huge nerd, and I don't think anybody is into the monoliths as much as him. Because that's why he's, like, obsessed with working with Nilfgaard, is because they allow him to explore the monoliths.
This is true.
So he might be an expert on the monoliths, and he might be the only one of the living mages.
I don't know.
But it is awkward. And also, Triss has got to know it's going to be awkward. Oh, she
knows. Are you kidding me? Of course she knows. That's what I'm trying to say. She just...
Like, she couldn't give him a little heads up, like, okay, so my very good friend also happens to be Yen's ex-boyfriend. Like, her very first boyfriend who taught her stuff about magic.
And a lot of other things he taught her. They taught each other. They were teaching each other a lot of things. Oh my gosh, it's crazy.
So I don't know, whatever, maybe she didn't feel like she had time, but I'm by the end of the season, I'm pretty out on Triss, so
you're so hard on her.
It's hard for me to be generous with her God. Right now.
It's so great. I mean, there is a funny part based on this pairing that we'll talk about in the next episode, but oh man, I get a kick out of this. Anyway, why is it that, speaking of Triss and Yen, why is it that their stories are flip-flopped here from Blood of Elves, like, in this series? Like, what is it I mean, a lot of what happens in Yen's story is really Triss's story in the book.
Well, the main thing is that in the book, everyone thinks Triss is dead, right? She's one of the 14 mages who died at Sodden Hill. And obviously she didn't die. And we even thought, when I remember when we talked about the finale of last season, we were wondering if Triss was dead. Yeah, I mean, I would have been terribly disappointed if she was, but like we did speculate. I think the show doesn't actually know what to do with Yen because she's not in a lot of Blood of Elves.
Yeah, I agree. That's a fair point. I also think, like, man, and you know, I haven't read some books further down. There's some further, so maybe we'll find out more about this. But I know in Blood of Elves, there's a passage where Triss does, you know, sees a vision. I'll leave it vague because we're going to talk about this later on because it's kind of touched on later on in the next episode that we're going to cover. But in that moment, like, what she's confronted with says, you're already dead, right? You're already dead. Like, you're dead. And refers to her as the 14th. And like, you know, basically that she died at Sodden Hill. And that jarred me when I was reading the book because I'm rereading it and it jarred me. Like, right, I read it again. I went back. I was like, let me read this again. And I was like, wait, is she alive or is she dead? Is she thought to just be dead or is she actually like, is what's going on with Triss? So I don't know. It's a little theory I've got in my mind, but I'm a little bit like shook a little bit about whether she actually survived Sodden Hill. We know she's burned. We know all these things. But remember, they use magic to keep her alive as well. So what happened to her there? It's a lot.
She is changed.
She's
right?
Changed.
So they changed her hair. There's something a little bit off about the performance here too. She's definitely changed. So I think that what we're supposed to understand is that Triss, Yen, Sabrina, they've all been traumatized from what happened at Sodden Hill. I think the show is really trying to portray what the cost of winning Sodden Hill was for the Brotherhood and for the mages on both a personal level, but also on a institutional level. 14 mages, a lot of mages to lose, exactly. You know? I mean, I guess they lost 13, but like that's a lot of people for the Brotherhood. And mages generally live pretty long. So I think we should keep an eye on Triss for sure.
I think so too. I mean, she doesn't want to get in the water when they're all in at Aretuza.
I don't think she wants anyone to see her scars.
That could be it. That's what we're led to believe. That's what I thought when I first saw it, and I still kind of hold that that's probably it. But I just kind of think like it's interesting. I guess with that information that I got, the show has given us no reason to believe any of this. But with the information I got when I was reading about that, when she's in the middle of that vision and that voice keeps telling her that she is the 14th, you're already dead. You died on the hill. That really like jarred me. And I was like, well, wait, is she alive or is she dead? What's going on? Like, what is happening with Triss? So I guess we'll find out as we progress through the story. And obviously, as you and I read more and more of these books, will know the answer to these questions. But I just found it. I find it interesting. I think that there's some mystery about what's happened to her after the hill, in my opinion.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the King of Redania, Vizimir, not Vesemir. Vizimir.
Not Vesemir. Vizimir. Vizimir, not Vesemir. Yeah.
I mean, he's an interesting character. I think we definitely need to keep an eye on him. Let me just say, I think I said this to you offline. Redania's like kings are garbage. Like they're all pretty terrible. Redania is like the kingdom that is constantly like trying to figure. Let me put it to you this way. Redania is like the Peter Baelish of this kingdom. They're always trying to climb. They're always like they're just always trying to mess with other people to get more power, to get more influence. He does not seem like a cool guy. He obviously has a like a pretty intensive intelligence operation. We don't see, like, Foltis doesn't seem to have a very good intelligence operation. But I also noted that when Vizimir was talking to Foltis at the dedication ceremony, he was kind of trying to sow discord between the Brotherhood and Foltis, who came to the Brotherhood's rescue at Sodden Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't help that Triss is Foltis's mage and she's MIA.
Yeah.
So he's definitely there to kind of exploit weaknesses. And I just don't trust this guy at all. Like, that whole conversation is about who's trustworthy. And I'm sitting there like, Foltis, don't trust this dude. He's not to be trusted.
Especially if you're comparing him to Peter Baelish, that he probably has his mind in the future and the past and everything all at the same time. What a weird shit. Anyway, yeah, no, it's weird. I'm glad you picked up on that, because I don't know what to make of Foltis, man. Sometimes I feel like, oh, this guy's like, he's gonna come out and like do the right thing, and then sometimes his intentions are a little bit murky to me, you know what I mean, sometimes.
So we'll see. I mean, I think Foltis is a very typical character in this story, which is just like, we know that Foltis has blood on his hands. We know that Foltis is not necessarily what we would call like a good or moral person. But sometimes those characters are just complicated, right? Like,
yeah.
No one is really perfect in this story, which is one of the reasons that makes this world compelling, because there isn't that black and white, good and bad. Like, you and I even talked about how we spent like the entirety of our first season coverage dunking on Fringilla, but we really like Fringilla in this season.
Oh,
like
a lot. Yeah.
And I think that's sort of the power of the story, that people can be redeemable and unredeemable, and like they can also be villains but also heroes at some point. I mean, Geralt's not your standard hero, but we will stand whatever he does, even when he's wrong. There's like one thing he did wrong this season we haven't gotten to yet that I like was almost like, you're dead to me, but but in general, man, like, this is the power of the story. Like, I don't know what to think of Foltis either, and I kind of like it that way.
Yeah, me too.
Like, I kind of like that Foltis is just complicated. Like, we know he has this complicated history with his sister and his daughter slash niece. Awkward. But like, I think that like he tried to do the right thing in the end by coming to the aid of the mages when they put their neck on the line for the Northern Kingdom. So,
no, definitely. You know, and speaking of these guys, you know who else I'm not really sure about? This pet owl. What's happening with this pet owl?
I mean, can we really answer the question? The owl has a point of view.
Yes, I know. And there's something magical clearly that's happening here, right? We're not going to talk more about it than that because we don't spoil things, but there is something happening for sure. And I think it's interesting to kind of see like the whole scene with Dijkstra and Vizimir from that point of view, and see like what's going on. And, you know, it's great. I think great foreshadowing for things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the owl, we obviously know something magical is going on. And when I first saw the owl, I kind of assumed somebody like enchanted the owl to be its eyes and ears. And I think that's, you know, still technically right. But the owl's point of view was very interesting. This show is very jarring. Like, a lot of points, you're not quite sure what you should be paying attention to. And I, for sure, on my first watch, was like, what the heck is going on with this owl?
Yeah, 100%. 100% where I was, too. And I mean, the other place I was shows you how different stories can leave an imprint on you, that I felt nothing weird about Dijkstra having full conversations with an owl, because it just made me think of like his Dark Materials, and I was like, oh yeah, sure, he's talking to his demon. It's fine. No problem.
No, totally. Totally. You know what I mean? So I was, when I first saw the owl, I was kind of like, oh, is this like a demon?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly where, like, I was. So it didn't make me feel weird at
all.
And
like, I don't remember this ever happening, but I feel like in His Dark Materials, there's times where it feels like the Golden Monkey's point of view is being represented. Yep. Or Stelmaria's point of view is being represented. And that's how this felt to me, even though this is very clearly the owl's point of view. So I think it's definitely something worth keeping an eye on, because yeah, you're right. Like, if you watch enough fantasy, you start to make assumptions.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened to me. I was like, oh, wait. Oh, yeah, that's crazy. I mean, another thing that I think would be good to touch on is Triss and Geralt talking about Ciri's abilities, because this really is a big part of what's going to continue to play out, especially in next episode, and just how unusual they are. They know that it's not chaos, but she can't use Witcher signs, right? She can't use the sign of Ard or any of those signs, but she can see things ahead of when they happen. She has the ability of foresight. We find that out when they go to they run into Tisea after the Battle of Sodden Hill, and she's like, I've seen this before, right? And other times. So, I mean, what do you think about, I mean, their conversation here and what they're kind of taking apart?
I think it had to be said, because I think in the preview episode, I think I said that we don't think that Ciri's magic is chaos. Mm-hmm. I have to be honest with you, it's not even Ciri's magic that I'm going off of. It's Pavetta's magic. Yeah. Pavetta's magic feels really different than what we've seen the other mages be able to do. And it doesn't appear to be as draining. Like, if we go back to the betrothal of Pavetta and Dooney, Pavetta basically destroys the entire throne room with all those mm-hmm. people in it, and it doesn't seem to take that much out of her. Now, if Yen did that, she would need a nap for sure.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem to really impact her as much as you know, chaos has this give and take. We learned the first time we learned about chaos, we learned that you don't get anything for free. That if you draw power from somewhere, like, you can drain that power. Power is not infinite. Chaos is not infinite. So, not to say that Ciri's power is infinite, but I liked this conversation because I think it was really important to note that it's different from what Triss is used to seeing. It's maybe not, like, maybe the difference in power doesn't matter or isn't there. We can't determine that yet, but for sure there's something different about Ciri's ability to channel than there is from Yen or Tisea or Triss or Stregobor, any of them. She doesn't seem to be the same kind of, like, raw blunt force with theirs.
Yeah, and I think what I'm I hate to keep saying stuff like this, but I really am interested in why the showrunners and the writers here are playing so coy with this information, because, as you know, like, by chapter 3 of like Blood of Elves, there's some real deep conversations about what this means, like, beyond just it's not chaos. Like, they get really deep in the weeds of, like, what Ciri potentially could be, and I wonder why there has to be some big reveals that are going to be in, you know, obviously in subsequent episodes that we know about, but also subsequent seasons, because it kind of feels like they're not giving you the information of this, what this is, for a reason. You know what I mean? For a real reason.
Yeah. And I think that for us as people who love this show and are talking about it, for an audience, it's tough because the show has revealed some things about Ciri, but it is, you know, they're playing coy with some mm-hmm. of it. And then they revealed something that isn't even part of the source material. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I don't get it either. I hope there's like a long-term game plan. I do suspect, though, that you can't talk about Cirilla's origin in one sentence the way you can with, Lyra Balacqua, mm-hmm. Jon Snow, mm-hmm. Luke Skywalker, Harry Potter. Like, she doesn't have an easy, here's the story of Cirilla.
No, not at all.
So I think part of it is they're giving us nuggets, and we'll talk about one of those later. But it's a little muddled even in the world's lore of like where, who she is, what her, like, it's not always perfectly clear.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree.
So I think that might be some of it, that like the mystery of Cirilla's power is a mystery in the world to the characters. It gives Geralt something to do, which is to figure out who, like, why she's so important. But I think they could be clearer about it for sure. And I just don't, some of the withholding, I don't fully understand.
Yeah, me neither. And that's what I'm interested in like kind of figuring out more about. But we'll see. And you know, why don't we talk a little bit about Ciri's origin and go into what you like, some of the, or potentially, we don't know where this Ciri's origin totally, but like the story of Falca's Rebellion.
Wait, before we get into that, I do want to talk about the hilarious exchange between Yaskier and the guard in Oxenfurt.
And Dara's glow up, of course. I mean, he is,
Oh, yes, we totally forgot. How could we? Look at us. We are a mess. Dara returns to this episode. He's had a full-on glow up. Good to see him. I was excited to see him. All of these kids are growing too fast. Him and Cirilla look way too old. Very upsetting.
Yeah, it's wild.
This is what delays due to coronavirus and Henry Cavill getting hurt due to us.
Oh my gosh.
They just make me feel old. But let's talk about this whole exchange of Yaskier and the guard. So the guard is basically like,
yeah, Yaskier. Oh my God. He's a big fan.
You're such a big star. Except, you know, this one song is not my favorite. And this exchange, I was cracking up. It took me to the fourth verse to understand that there were different timelines. I spotted the green, I spotted the dragon reveal a mile away.
Oh, it's so good.
You can criticize Lauren Hristich, but she has a sense of humor. This is funny. This is like anyone who has talked to other people about this show and how confusing it was. This was like taking it exactly from conversations about it. Yeah. Like, it really starts to come together in episode 4 when you realize there's multiple timelines.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
It was great. It was like super cool that she did that. It's like so meta, but it was also like really fit in the story. And it was like, to be honest, it's perfect because the bard is really the person telling all these stories of everything happening in the world, right? Similar to like how we always felt like Sam was going to end up and you know, being how Sam was telling the story in Game of Thrones, we thought. You know what I mean? If you know, who knows? If you haven't seen it, I won't spoil it for everybody because I'm good at that. But the point is that's what I feel like. I feel like the bard is that person. He's like, I'm telling the story here. Like, I'm the one writing this. So it's pretty funny that she put it in his.
He also had himself get together with the two ladies, the Zarakanian women.
Yeah.
The guard is like, that part didn't ring true.
It didn't ring true at all. Like a little embellishment happening there. Yeah, that was wow.
Yeah, it's good. And it's also just funny because of how defensive Yaskier gets. And that's how, you know, the people who wrote the show felt when they were getting all this criticism about how confusing it was. They felt defensive too. So I just thought it was funny that they poked fun at themselves. It was a good joke. I thoroughly appreciated it.
Yeah, it's good. It's very good. This season is great.
Yeah, some of the dialogue is great. So let's talk about Stregobor's little PowerPoint presentation or slide deck is the as people say these days, about Falco's rebellion. So Stregobor tries to terrify the members of the Brotherhood with this precautionary tale about Falco's rebellion, which was an event that occurred approximately 100 years before Cirilla was born. Falco was the disinherited daughter of King Vidank of Redania, who divorced her mother, Beatrix, and sent their only child away, and had an entirely new family. Did I not say earlier that the Redanian trash kings are garbage?
Trash. Yes, you did.
So after 25 years of living in exile, Falco returned to Redania, determined to claim her place as the rightful heir. And during this rebellion, she killed everybody. She killed her father, her stepmother, her two half-brothers. And she also accidentally imprisoned Queen Rhiannon of Temeria during the rebellion. Rhiannon had twins while she was imprisoned, a boy and a girl, and then had a complete mental health crisis during her captivity. Around the same time, Falca had a child herself and left the daughter, her daughter, in the hands of Rhiannon to be cared for. After Falca was captured and killed, she supposedly cursed all humankind and their future generations. And when she was dead, no one knew, including Rhiannon, which of the two girls that she was caring for were Falca's daughter. Some believed it to be Fiona, and others believed it to be Adela. This is where things get a little bit complicated. Rhiannon was the orphan daughter of Lara Doran and Creganon of Lod, the fabled elven warrior and her beloved human mage that we learned about in episode 1, when Nevillian told that story to Ciri. Fiona was acknowledged as a daughter of Rhiannon after the king had sorcerers determine that Adela was actually Falca's child. And Fiona, it turns out, is Cirilla's great-great-grandmother. So there's still questions about this, and later information is discovered that might, you know, throw doubt on who Fiona's mother actually was. The reason that this is important is if Fiona was indeed the child of Lara Doran and Creganon of Lod, then it would seem to confirm that Cirilla is indeed the child from Ifline's prophecy. But what if the common knowledge is wrong and Fiona is actually Falca's daughter? Then Cirilla could be the manifestation of Falca's curse on future generations.
Heavy. Heavy. Man.
Yeah. And this is what I'm talking about when I say it's not really like a neat, easy story to tell, right? Like, There is a prophecy here, but there's sort of multiple prophecies, and Cirilla could be the child of, you know, the descendant of either one of these prophecies. And also, we're hearing a lot of this secondhand, yeah, right? This is not like this was written down in perfect text. Like, a lot of this is information that was passed on through generations. So it's not entirely clear how much of even Falca cursing everybody when she was put to death is even true. That's what the legends say. That's what was passed down. So I thought it was interesting that they kind of dropped that into the story as well, after having previously told us the story of Lara and her husband, who she fell in love with, and you know, it was against the rules that existed in the world at the time. So another reason that some of this might be, they might be playing a little coy with some of these details, is I don't know how far blood origin is going to get in its story, but it could be that maybe they're trying to save some of this.
Oh, they could actually be
for the other show. Like,
yeah, it's a good call, because we could get some of the Falco's Rebellion stuff and everything later on, later seasons in that show, and yada yada. That's a good call. That's a really
good call. I mean, I think we at some point in that show we will meet Laura Dorn.
Yeah, that's a good call. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a really good call.
Yeah, I wonder if, I don't know if we'll get as far as Falca's Rebellion, because that actually takes us quite close. I think Geralt is born only a few years after Falca's Rebellion, so it's not like it's you know, that distant history. But I do think that we'll probably meet Laura Dorn at some point in the story of the Blood Origin show.
Yeah, I mean, you and I spoke a little offline. We're seeing, like, you know, the woman in the hut thing, like that whole motif. There has to, like, you know, there has to be something there about that, and you know, like, basically, like, and then the monolith stuff and all of that, and they keep referencing the conjunction of the spheres. So we're gonna see, I think, a lot of things about how the conjunction happened, who some of the first monsters were, what happened, all that stuff's gonna come together, I feel like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and these are two different writing teams. Yeah. So if they manage to pull it off, this kind of like building the lore into the main show to support the plot of the spinoff, I think it's really effective. I just don't know. We're wildly speculating. Like, we don't know anything about, we don't actually know anything about Blood Origin, except that it will take place, you know, either right after the conjunction of the spheres or, you know, within a few years after. So, like, we don't really know much about that show. I'm just kind of trying to draw conclusions because I do think the show could have just told us who Cirilla is at this point.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, you know, and Falca also was like she was a warrior, right? So that's why she left her child. Like, it was like, I'm not going to take my child to war. And, you know,
She left her in the care of another queen.
And I honestly, man, the imprisonment portion of it, I kind of always wondered about what was going on there, the accidentally imprisoned, or what that really means. It's worded very interestingly to kind of play on, like, okay, was this like an intentional thing to mix this up? Like, did they, you know what I mean? It's just, there's something going on there with all of this that's good. It gives me a lot of, you know, Jon Snow parentage, like, you know, what and what happens in the tower and the whole thing. Like, it's, something's going on. You know what I mean? And it makes sense.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it's intentionally mysterious, which is good because it does sort of make me want to read on and figure out exactly what is going on with Cirilla. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure it really, like, in terms of what it means for the story, I'm not sure that I care strongly, but I do, maybe I'm just feeling burned from Game of Thrones, but I do actually want to see where the show lands on this, because it's not, if you look at the fan communities, the conversation online, you actually get a bit of debate about this, about Adela and Fiona and who was, you know, like, who was actually Falca's daughter and who was Rhiannon's daughter.
Well, I think that's what they're hinting at later on in the next episode we'll talk more about. I think it's a little bit more spelled out in the book, but I think this is what Triss starts to grapple with, and we'll talk about that more in the next episode, you know. But I think that and one of the things that everybody's grappling with in this episode, and a big theme that we're noticing, is the scars that people carry. You know, we've now kind of firmly settled into what's happening in season two, and, you know, all of our main players in this world are, you know, they're nursing wounds. Some are old, some are new. Triss is actually scarred with burns that she suffered at Sodden Hill, and it makes her really eager to share in the pain and the suffering of others. Like, she's, you know, there, like, trying to help at Kaer Morhen and really digging into what's going on there. Yen's grappling with the loss of her powers. Irritated with that. More on that later. She's not sure who she is after losing the one thing that kind of made her feel whole in this story. Cirilla is trying to fight her way through the grief of the loss of her whole entire family. She lost her grandparents. You know, she lost Malsak. She lost Sir Laszlo. I mean, do we really care that she lost Sir Laszlo?
She brings him up.
I mean, I guess that's true.
She brings Laszlo up, and he did die in defense of her.
He did. Good on Laszlo. I know. It's just he was. I never was like big on him. He was a little. He's like a notch below. Not like in a bad way. I wasn't out on him or anything. Seemed like a good dude, but just like okay, cool. Like I didn't. I felt like there was something.
So what you're saying is he was the poor man
Barristan Selmy?
Selmy, yeah.
I mean, poor in comparison to my man Barristan is like, that's an understatement. Barristan is the man. So like, yeah, no, I'm not a fan. If we were comparing those two, that guy, yeah, no, not even close. Not close. But anyway, she does miss Sir Laszlo, so she's missing all of them. And Vesemir is coping with the loss of not just Eskel, but also all of the young boys he trained to be witchers. You know, there's a lot going on there. And, you know, the fact that witchers are dying the way that they are. And Yaskier is basically singing his heartache through his song and very upset that Geralt cast him aside. And so in these two episodes, we deal largely with the scars beneath the skin that stay with us and they shape us. They're things that like we just can't get rid of. You know, they actually form part of how we see the world and our worldview. Each of these characters is coping in their own way, but all of them are looking for ways to move forward and push past the pain. The world of The Witcher is one that has a lot of loss and pain within it. The continent is a really tough and unforgiving place, yet each character strives to move beyond their loss and find new identities and meaning for themselves. It's, you know, really, really telling. Like, that's one of the things that Cahir and Yennefer speak about, right? Like, they and Yaskier and her speak about. So, you know, character is an important part of the journey in this world. And Yaskier becomes an ally of the oppressed after his loss. And he creates a new identity there. Yen puts others before herself. And, you know, she could have killed Cahir. Instead, she doesn't. She's trying to help other people and also tries to save Yaskier when she thinks that something might have happened to him. And Cirilla wants to become stronger, faster, and better so that she can overcome her fears. The takeaway really is that, you know, after suffering, after pain, there will always be another day and a path forward. And we have to decide what we'll do with that new day and how we'll live out, you know, based on the not only the things that we've experienced, but what we'll do with those experiences to push forward.
Yeah, this was like, you know, there's a lot of reunions in this episode, but a lot of them were tough, right? Like Yen, Triss, and Sabrina. That was actually hard to watch. You know, the last time we saw Sabrina, I actually thought Sabrina was dead. So the fact that she survived, but also just living with what she did in the battle, it was nice to see them together. And it was nice to see that they were able to kind of talk through some of what had happened, but it was a tough reunion. And then Yaskier and Yen, obviously these two are extremely heartbroken. And Triss is just a mess. Like, I think she went to Kaer Morhen because she couldn't stay at Aretuza because she wanted to be useful. So I think that everybody in this story is really struggling with something profound. I mean, Geralt thinks Yen is dead.
Yeah, that's a rough one, right? So like he's struggling with that for sure.
He's grieving too, and he's trying to throw himself into being a good like parent, I guess, for lack of a better word, to Cirilla. But he's also feeling pain. And he just had to kill one of his best friends.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a interesting time on the continent and things that they're navigating. It shows and it's, again, this is similar to last year. There was a lot last season. There was a lot of pain that people were navigating. So as you know, we talked about, this is kind of like a theme on the continent that people, you know, have to push forward past the different things that they experience.
The continent is a terrible place. Like, it just No, for real. Like, Geralt says it multiple times this season. Like, it is, like, it is a really unforgiving, painful, scary place. And the fact that people do find joy and happiness and success in it is admirable, because it's a really tough world that they live in.
Yeah.
But obviously there's these relationships that these characters have make it worth fighting forward, you know?
Oh, I agree.
Or they wouldn't bother.
I agree. And so that brings us to a close this week. And yeah, please follow us on Kin Folklore Pod on Twitter, on Instagram. Also, you can join our Facebook group. Go ahead and go wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us those 5-star reviews. We really appreciate all your support. And we look forward to digging deeper into the world of the continent in weeks to come. We'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.